Welcome to the 9-8s podcast hosted by yours truly, Kevin Thompson, founder and CEO of 9-8 Capital Group. Thank you guys for joining us. As I always say, subscribe to the channel. As I always say, go and get my book, MLB to CFP, live on Apple and Amazon. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at info@9-8capitalgroup.com. Send us your questions. Go to the website at www.9-8capitalgroup.com. Schedule an appointment. As you know, we're here to do what? Educate, power, engage, also entertain. And don't forget to follow us on all our social media channels at MLB to CFP. Guys, we're having a conversation today with Dr. John Harvey of TCU and PhD, talking about MMT isn't inflationary. We're going to go deep into what inflation is, why it is, and should you be concerned. You don't want to miss this episode. Let's get it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Dr. John T. Harvey, PhD, Hal Wright Professor of Economics, TCU. Dr. Harvey, thank you for joining the 9-8s podcast today, my friend.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Well, you know, so I'm going to give you a little bit of a information. Yeah. Information is, the reason why we're on this podcast is because I had a LinkedIn dispute with someone, right? The LinkedIn.
I've never had a dispute on LinkedIn before. I'll have to try that.
No, yeah. So I'm having a conversation about what we call MMT, modern monetary theory. I read Dr. Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm always trying to get educated, trying to get my knowledge, trying to get that little wrinkle in the brain, right? So, right. Yeah. So I'm listening to this. I'm having a conversation, and then I'm writing in here, and by the way, Dr. Kelton was supposed to be on my podcast maybe a few years ago, but that's an aside. So I'm going in there, I say, hey, Dr. Kelton, great book. You mentioned the fly in the ointment being inflation, and by the way, I don't want to jump ahead, but mentioned the fly in the ointment being inflation, and then someone says, oh, you know, someone came in and started talking to me about this, this, and this. We go 16 threads down. You know how that gets. You get 16 threads down, and then she says to me, oh, I was misinformed by you. You were here to do harm. I'm like, excuse me? No, I'm asking questions. So
Right.
Then they mention your name. You said, you need to contact this guy and have a conversation with Dr. Harvey. So I said, you know what? I'm going to do that, and boom. Here we are unto this day, inflation, MMT, and fiscal policy, my friend.
Perfect. You know, and by the way, we had Dr. Kelton down this time last year. Mm-hmm. I brought her in as a speaker, took her out to the stockyards, let her watch bull riding. So it was a heck of a good time.
Yeah, she's a wonderful person. I know, again, I'm going to get her hopefully on my show here shortly. So let's just get right to it. Right now, we're in an inflationary time, right? We can't deny it. Some people say it's because we're spending too much money as the government. Some people say that we're just pushing a lot of money into the economy. Other people say that, hey, you know what? It's just a natural rate of inflation. Just whatever side you're actually on, right? In your opinion, because this is your world. Yeah. What is causing that current inflationary environment? Is it monetary policy? Is it supply chains? Is it corporate pricing power, labor shortages, or is it something else? Or is it all of the above?
Well, you know, there are so many misconceptions about inflation, and it is exhausting. I mentioned I have pages of notes here.
And that's what we're here to clear up today. I know.
Oh, yeah. And I was trying to think, how am I going to start? Like it's this big circle of all this misconception. It's like, well, I got to scooch in somewhere, and somewhere is better than. So here's where I'm going to start. Inflation is not one number. Okay. We treat it like it's one number. Mm-hmm. It's 6%, it's 8%, it's 5%. No. It's a set of numbers that they average together. It's a weighted average. Mm-hmm. And whenever you look at the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you'll find, like, let's say inflation 6%. Okay, you'll look up the individual categories. Oh, some rose faster than 6%, some rose slower than 6%, and some fell, all right, at the same time. They were just getting the average, right? So if you just get the average, then you're missing the story. And let me give you the weights
Okay. Yeah, the
on
owner
the.
equivalent of this win. You're gonna talk. I'm sorry, I didn't want to jump in there. Go
Oh
ahead.
yeah. These are the weights that they use as of December 2024. 44% of CPI is housing, right? So, for example, there was a question that came up about a year ago. Hey, DFW inflation is running faster than the rest of the country. Why is that? Well, it was housing prices, all right? So now think about that. Are we suffering because of rising housing prices? Well, not if I already got a house.
True.
That case, I'm actually gaining from it. Now, if I'm trying to move here, then yes, it's an issue. But then, why would we want to stop housing prices from going up if that then causes more houses to be built? Because what the consumers want is more houses. So they bid up the prices. It makes it profitable to build more houses. So, it's not even clear that inflation is always necessarily a bad thing. It's supposed to set into motion. The market is like, people say, are you pro or anti-market? Well, that's like asking them, are you pro or anti-hammer? If I've got a nail to drive in a piece of wood, I'm very pro-hammer. But if I've got a big piece of wood I want to make into smaller pieces of wood, I'm pro-saw. So it's all about what is the job at hand. So, in terms of the market system, I think there's things that it does very well and things that it doesn't do very well. And one of the things it does do well is when prices go up, it tends to attract more resources to whatever that is, and sort of, you try to solve it. So anyway, that 44% is housing, 17% is transportation, 15% is food and beverages. And by the way, that's always an interesting one to look up because they break it between food at home and food out to eat. And clearly you can, if the food away from home is going up, well then don't go out to eat. So all these things that they sort of factor in here. Gas prices are just 3%. But
Which is interesting.
if you've got a 3% going up by 50%, which sometimes we see gas prices do, actually it ends up being a pretty big roll overall. But the average weight is only 3%. So we've got all these categories, medical care, and so forth. And let me give you a couple of examples here. I always tell my students, you always have to go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics webpage. In fact, for the listeners of this, all you got to remember is six letters: CPIBLS. You put that in your search engine, it's going to go straight to the place where you can see a breakdown. Is this eventually a video
Yes,
podcast?
this is gonna be a video. This is
Okay,
a video.
I'm just going to show you. I know it's not going to be legible, but that's off the Bureau of Labor Statistics webpage. And it's got the breakdown of all the different categories. And so I just pulled up a couple of recent periods of inflation to give people kind of a feel of how different it can be. One number has got to be broken down into individual numbers. This is from December 2020. So we had COVID for what, about 10 months at that point, right? Now, at this point in December of 2020, energy prices had fallen by 20% as people just weren't going out and driving around and so forth. So the overall rate of inflation was quite low. It was 1.4%. But among those, you've got what? Oh, the one that's really interesting is used car prices. I don't know if you remember this, but at this point, they'd only gone up by 10% over the previous year. But man, let me switch to page two. July 2021, when we have a little bit over a year of COVID, and used cars and trucks up by 41% in prices. And why? Well, we all know why. Because there was a shortage of chips coming from China. Oh, I have a horrible personal story here. My computer died about this time. And of course, chips are in short supply. And I'm a big computer gamer, so I want a good computer. And it cost me more than twice as much as my previous computer because these chip prices going up. So, also during that summer of July 2021, that was our second summer of COVID, energy prices went way up. Well, part of that was supply chain, part of that was economies were recovering, part of that was extreme weather events like we had in Texas. You have to break it down and look at the individual factors. I'm going to give you one more period that I pulled out here, and this is March 2022. In February of 2022, according to President Trump, Ukraine invaded Russia. According to the rest of the world, Russia invaded Ukraine, all right? Now, energy prices skyrocketed. We have a 50% increase in the price of gas, 50% increase in fuel oil because of how important that area of the world is for energy and food as well. Food was going up. And so, we know why it happened. It's not a shock or a surprise. Now, here's my question. All right. So this is how we should understand inflation. We should understand it sectorally. It's always in a sector. It's always in a specific place and caused by a specific thing. All right. So how do we solve this? Well, look at March 2022 when gas prices are skyrocketing. Do we solve this by raising interest rates in the U.S.? Because that's our tool we usually use. Our tool we use is, oh, well, we better jack up the interest rates and lower the inflation. That does not solve a shortage. That does not cause more chips to be created when we're short of chips. It doesn't cause more gasoline to exist when we. All it does is it treats a symptom. Hey, I know. Let's make people so poor they can't afford the gas anyway, and then the price will fall, which is true, but it's not really a solution, right? It's not a solution. And actually, to the Fed's credit, most of the time I disagree with what they say, but to the Fed's credit, at the time, that is what they were saying. Well, we can't solve the shortages caused by COVID. The only thing that can solve it is getting rid of COVID, right? So the raising the interest rates is not a good solution. It treats a symptom, and as I said, it can actually inflation can play a positive role. Do you remember early in COVID, they didn't know how it spread and so forth. So there was a big jump in medicinal alcohol prices. And I know this because I decided as one of my things I was going to do during COVID was to get a 3D printer. And with the 3D printer, you needed that alcohol to clean it out. God, I couldn't even find it. And then when I did find it, it used to be like $1.50 and now it's $15. So, should the government have stepped in and stopped those prices from rising by taking income away from me? No, they let the prices go up. And you know what? That it meant more got produced. Literally, companies that usually made scotch and whiskey cut
Started
back
making
on how much of
act.
that they made, started making medicinal alcohol. So you must look at the specific circumstances. There is no one size fits all for a solution or a cause. And I will get to your question, by the way. I do have what's causing it right now, but I kind of want to create a framework where people are thinking to themselves, it's not one number.
I want to kind of pivot a little bit because you mentioned a couple of things there that I that put a wrinkle in my brain. You said that like for me, psychologically, when someone sees gas prices going up, that's the psychology of us in regards to that directly impacts our spending, right? So that's so right now they're saying, oh, well, if we keep saying inflation, if we keep saying inflation, it's bound to continue to go up. Well, yes and no, but at the end of the day, like people see real things, like owner's equivalent rent being 26 or 27%, and then you have the actual rent prices being another percentage of that, or homeowners prices being another percentage of that, making up that 35 to 40% number. What does that actually mean? Are you just calling someone up and say, hey, what do you think you can rent your house out for? You know what I mean? It's just a number that doesn't really make sense to me. But it's a huge component of CPI, like you just mentioned, and then all the other subcategories. And why I think it needs to be taken with a grain of salt, because if we're talking about home prices in California moving versus home prices in some rural town of Alabama, I mean, but you're putting everything together. It's like, oh, well, this is what we got for CPI. Oh, not necessarily. CPI is a little bit different in Alabama than it is in California,
And
right?
they do break it down. They do calculate it separately, but that's a good point. I'm sitting here pointing out you should break it down by category, and you're pointing out we also need to break it down spatially too, which is very
Regionally, but
different.
micro, the micro side of things.
Break it down place to place, and that's absolutely right as well. But the way they do this, by the way, is they survey people periodically to see what kind of stuff do you buy. And then they create what they call a basket of goods, and then they reprice all those goods monthly. For example, they no longer have included in the basket of goods, how many VHS cassettes do you typically rent at Blockbuster every month?
I just got three. I got three in there now.
Well,
Just picked them up yesterday.
that's got to go into our average then. But yeah, so they do this, and then they do it for individual cities, and then they weight them by, I suppose, I don't actually know how they weight the overall average. I would assume by population, but clearly, inflation in Waxahachie is not going to be the same as it is in Los Angeles. So, you know, but the whole approach to inflation as if it's one number, and as if it's one number that's always bad and must be addressed, is very damaging. For example, here's another source of inflation: when there's a shortage of labor. Well, why isn't it okay for them to have their prices bid up? I mean, if I'm selling, I don't know, marker pens, and there's a big increase in demand for purple marker pens because let's go back in time and have TCU beat Georgia in that.
Was a close game, by
it was right up
the
until they said play ball.
way.
But you know, if there's this big demand for purple pens that I make, and so the prices start going up, well, geez, that's good for me. I'm making something people want. Why not? So, you know, we talk about, and it's become such a problem that both parties, at least a couple of election cycles ago, started recognizing that the middle class is being destroyed. Well, if we throw the economy into recession every time there's a labor shortage, go, oh no, that's going to cause prices to go up. Well, of course it is. And that's okay. Those people down the bottom, when their services are in demand, why shouldn't they get to earn more? I mean, we feel like it's okay for CEOs, and we feel like it's okay, you know, for other folks. And so that's another kind of inflation. I have a book forthcoming on U.S. business cycles,
Oh,
and
you gotta get that to me, man. 'Cause I'm big in wage stagnation since 1980. It's just been bad. You've seen, I don't, we'll get there. It's
oh
another
yeah,
conversation.
I have a section on that. The book, it goes through kind of theory, first of all, and I wrote it for the average person, not for the economist. And then I also have in the back, I have all the math and stuff, but in the front, it's just like, here's how it works. And then I have a long section on U.S. business cycles since I think 1954 was the first year I could get all the data. I was like, okay, what caused everyone? What caused everyone? And then there's some issues that come up along the side as well. But in there, I spent the thing that took me the longest to write was the section on inflation. And my poor wife, she's my educated layperson that reads things for me. And some of the early sections were really bad. She was like, yeah, this doesn't make sense. I was like, ah, gotta start again. I was trying to
You're
think of
speaking like an economist, you know
it. Yeah,
what
that's right.
I mean? And a
Well,
professor.
I was trying to break it down and trying to say, you know, what's an easy way to understand this? And I ended up with kind of like six or seven different kinds of inflation. You know, for example, let's do the housing thing. All right. All right. So housing prices are going up. Well, that's good. More houses will be built. Well, not necessarily, but
I was gonna ask you about that. I don't agree with that. Go ahead.
yeah, that's right. Not necessarily, because we've got a couple of other issues involved there. One is, what if it's corporations buying up all these houses and half of them are sitting empty? I saw something on somewhere in the range of 30 to 40% of houses in Las Vegas are just being sat on by corporations because they're.
Blackstone and Carlyle Group.
Is that right?
Carlyle owns like almost 12%. It's ridiculous the amount of real
Wow,
estate they
wow,
own.
wow.
That's an aside.
And they're speculating. That's all they're doing. And that, you know, there's already a vehicle for speculation. It's called the stock market. Why don't y'all use that and not something that people need to live? And so they're driving up. So that's not a good kind of inflation. So how do we address that? Do we raise interest rates and throw the economy into recession? No. We do one of the things that Harris had talked about during her campaign, and that was that we introduce rules saying, you know, the corporations can only own X percent or something like that. They just shouldn't be allowed to speculate in something that's so important to Homo sapien life. Or the other problem is that we've got a lot of poor people in the area. Well, it's not that housing prices, it's the lack of a job that they've got. I mean, if we can stimulate the macroeconomy and create jobs for them, then the houses will get built. That's one of the things, by the way, way back in the 60s when they did all the inner city housing and that, there was one fella that quietly wrote an article about how it was a bad idea, and it didn't really expect much reaction to it, and he caught hell for it. He was like, look, the problem in the inner city is not a lack of housing, it's a lack
Lack
of
of
jobs.
jobs, yeah.
So creating the housing only has caused people to be anchored in a place that already doesn't have a good economy to start with.
Yeah.
Now they can't afford to move out. So if you had created jobs instead, the houses would have just got built. So again, it just points out that all these inflationary issues need to be understood for the specific situation, you know, that's going on. And let me just jump to you real quick here right now. What's going on right now? So I jotted all this down.
One
Oh, yeah,
question.
go ahead.
So what's the incentive? And this is where we talk about economics. What's the incentive for the business owner to invest? And that's where we have to come in. You have to give the incentive for the business owner to invest in, back into the inner cities to create those jobs. Otherwise, what's been happening, people will just buy up places, board them up, and then wait for the city to repurchase them from them. And
Well,
that's what's been going on with a lot of these inner cities.
right.
Bu buying up shops, buying up places, don't do anything with them, and then saying, hey, the city will eventually pay me for this. And that's when the gentrification comes in. So, anyways,
Man.
that's
No,
nice.
that's a huge issue. I was going to get into it a little later, but we can jump right
No,
now. It's
we
a
doesn't we're in a
flowing
bunch of different directions. It
conversation.
doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, it's a flowing conversation.
Yeah.
No, one of the things that you know when I talking about MMT and without even getting any specifics for it first, I always like to lay out for people a framework, and this is rarely done, about the way the macroeconomy works in the first place.
Okay.
And that is that the private sector does not automatically create a job for everybody who's willing to work. Right? It just doesn't. Labor is a cost. It is the major cost. And so the private sector is going to try to minimize the use of labor. Now, am I arguing against that? No, it makes things cheaper for me. That's fine, you know, but that means we get unemployment.
Yeah.
And this unemployment, when you end up with self-checkout screens at McDonald's and self-checkout lane, you know why they're doing that, to lower costs.
Lower
Which,
cost,
you know,
yeah.
and I have friends on the left who say, oh, never use the self-checkout lane. Oh, do you also not use banks that use computers and only use Abacus, you know, because Abacus
Yeah.
more people? I said, that's stupid. We should not have an economic system that punishes us for increased productivity. We should have an economic system that rewards us for increased productivity, but it doesn't.
Yes.
So in the household, it does. You know, think about it. Well, we have a dishwasher and a washer dryer that lowered the amount of labor, but that didn't cause little Jimmy to go hungry
Yeah.
because little Jimmy was allowed to eat at the table because little Jimmy's one of us. All right.
Yeah.
So the right to eat didn't come from, you know, you did the dishes or whatever. So in the household, when we have labor-saving technology, it creates a, you know, a healthier environment for us, but it doesn't in the macroeconomy. So we need a conscious understanding that we need the public sector to create employment. Furthermore, not just because there aren't enough jobs, but also because there are, what does the private sector do? The private sector does stuff that's profitable. Is everything that's good profitable?
Yeah.
No. There's a, I mean, and
Don't get me
many,
started with private equity, man. I go there all day long.
and there's many, many things that are profitable and good.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, restaurants are wonderful. You know, and I don't know, pens, whatever. But we don't do things like elder care. We don't do things like child care, health care, climate. But we're going to let that go to hell. If the government needs to create jobs to generate enough employment, and this is a big part of the MMT stuff, then they should be focusing on things that are socially beneficial but not profitable. Government shouldn't be competing with the private sector. Government shouldn't have a chain of hamburger stands. We don't need that. We've got them already.
That's almost like politics and policy, because at the end of the day, people are trying, the current administration, and I'm not trying to get into that, but they're running it like a business. And you can't run a country like a business when 70% of the revenue, or the 70% of the actual money that goes out, is non-revenue producing. So it's like, how do
That's
you
right.
produce? Your company will crumble if that was the case.
Right, that's right. No, in fact, John Harvey, a guy I know, wrote a piece for Forbes way back during the first Trump administration, specifically on you're not supposed to run the government like a business. The government is out. First of all, the government shouldn't be doing anything profitable. If they're doing
Nothing's
things that are profitable, then they're competing with the private sector, and that's not fair.
Wow.
You know, it's like in Shawshank Redemption.
Andy
That's right.
Dufresne.
And remember when the warden was running all those schemes and he was getting that real cheap prison labor? Well, that wasn't fair to the private sector, all right? So not the only reason why he was a bad man, but it was one. So the government should do things that are not profitable. I mean, the United States military is not profitable. I mean, unless we start invading places and stealing stuff, it's not profitable. But we all believe that there's a social use for this, that there's a social purpose for this. So we're, willing to feed people who aren't producing goods and services for us. Education is absolutely, I mean, and we're starving that right now. But educating the poor is what makes us not poor in the future. And so, we have all these things that we already do, police and fire. The police, talking about a socialist institutions, the police department, from each according to their abilities. We pay taxes based on how we are able to pay the taxes, but to each according to their needs. I call up and say there's somebody breaking into my house, and they come here and they don't say, what's your credit card number? They don't, say, well, you'll receive a bill later in the mail. And they say, well, but you pay taxes. Well, it doesn't matter if there's a German person visiting the stockyards that's getting robbed. That is their duty, and it's something that they are enthusiastic about doing to help protect that person. So we have things that are already, if you haven't read Pavlina Chernova's book, Chernev-A, it came out the same year as Stephanie Kelton's, and hers was all about the job guarantee. About what if we had a situation where I've looked in the private sector and I can't find anything. All right, so now I can be on welfare or assistance or whatever, or the government always has a job for me. Kind of like the during the Great Depression. And so you can get job skills. I mean, how many of the people on the east side of Fort Worth are never going to see a decent job because they don't
Well,
have any job skills?
I'm gonna push back a little bit because what another side would say is it's not like you just mentioned, it's not for the government to compete with the private sector. So now you're competing with the private sector and you're providing jobs for people. And what people are going to say is, well, now they're going to just stay in those jobs and not progress any further. And now that's just taxpayer dollars
They've
going out
already
the door.
thought
Now,
about
again,
that.
I'm just that's just
No. They've already
that's a
thought about
counter.
that. Part of the scheme is supposed to be that if this is private sector wages, this is public sector wages. So that this becomes a buffer stock over here, all right? That whenever the economy expands and the private sector is expanding, people will move from the public sector to the private sector because it pays better. And then when the economy contracts, they move back again. But the great thing is, when the economy contracts like it did in 2007, 8, up through about halfway through 2009, the people who are unemployed, they lost job skills. The longer they were unemployed, the harder it was to get another job. Not under this scheme. Not only are you continually working, and everybody knows it's easier to get a job when you have a job. So, they're continually working. Plus, with the job guarantee, we don't say, oh, you don't fit our skill set. We say, your skill set would actually work over here, or we need to help train you.
So you're talking about like a universal employment type of strategy.
Yeah, I guess so. And it's just going to get worse. I mean, as we automate, but in fact, it should get better. It should get better. I'm something of an introvert. So when I go to the
I'm right there
when
with
I
you.
go to the, yeah, I go to the grocery store, I want to use the self-checkout lane. I got my AirPods in and I'm listening to my music and I'm going through my and I go over there and quietly buy all my stuff and leave. So I got nothing against the private sector reducing its reliance on labor. Perfectly fine. But we have to understand that that has a consequence. And that is, it's going to be an even bigger, differential between the rich and the poor. And not only does that seem immoral and unjust and unnecessary, because we have the goods and services to feed these people. I mean, if somebody is on welfare or unemployment insurance, it's not like they're also going hungry at the same time. No, there's food on the shelf. So, the only thing they have is they have that additional layer of shame that they feel for themselves because they're going to blame themselves, as opposed to they're doing a public sector job and then they're going to the Walmart and buying stuff with money that they feel like they earned and wasn't just given to them.
Okay, so I want to take this back a little bit. And here's my question because this is something that's been on my mind. The Fed artificially kept rates low for over a decade, literally, quantitative easing, buying and selling mortgage-backed securities in the market. They artificially allowed people to get lower mortgages. So, how does that or does that impact inflation, or and are we in a new normal in regards to inflation? Is this the normal that where we're supposed to be normally because we've been so low for so long artificially, or is this something where it's like, hey, maybe we could go back to where we were without government intervention?
Well, first of all, and I'm looking up inflation right now while you're looking at data here. Okay, because I didn't think it was very high right now, and it's not.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's not, but there's a generation of people that have never experienced an 80s style. You know what I mean? There's a generation of kids like,
Oh,
oh, it's I can get a 2% mortgage. This is what it's supposed to be, you know?
yeah. No, I remember when I was learning to drive. I turned 16 in 1977. And gas prices are skyrocketing. It's like, well, great.
Wait,
And I
25
don't know if
cents,
people
50
realize
cents.
this. Back in those days, you would go to a gas station. First of all, most of them were they pumped the gas for you.
Yeah.
And it was really during the 70s and 80s that we got all the self-service because people started having self-service, which was cheaper. So we had to do that. And then you would ask for, I would like to get $3 worth. It was never fill it up. It's like, well, I
Yeah.
got $3 on me. And I'll sit there trying to get it exactly to $3 because it
Yeah.
was so expensive. So no, I lived and I remember living through that period and thinking, gosh, will inflation ever be low like low again? All right, so I guess let me talk about that first. The
Yeah.
big thing that caused all the inflation back then was the 1973 Arab-Israeli war.
Yeah.
And so, once they invaded and then the US helped out Israel because I love military history, so I can talk for an hour if you want about the 73 Arab-Israeli War and what the Syrians did and the Egyptians
Yeah,
did. It
yeah,
was really interesting because it was touch and go for Israel, really touch and go. So we help out, the US does, and they survive. And now the Arab countries, and I used to describe it to my students like this back when TCU was in the Southwest Conference.
yeah.
What if we were finally beating A&M? And it's like, 2 minutes left in the game and the referees call some penalty and they give the game away, obviously. So we'd be pissed off. Well, that's the way the Arab countries were. They're like, man, we had the Israelis beat. And then you stepped in and ruined it. Well, guess what? Y'all not getting any oil. And so they cut way back on production. And I don't know, the demand for oil is extremely price inelastic in that if you raise the price by 10%, will people cut back? Yeah, they'll cut back some, but they
Yeah.
won't cut back 10%. All
No, they
right.
won't.
So you're going to make more revenue. So that raises the question, well, why didn't the Arab countries do this before? Well, in order to make this stick, every one of the countries has to agree to a quota.
Yeah.
And your incentive, if we're going to raise the price, well, heck, I want as big a quota as possible for my country. And it was only after the Arab-Israeli War they said, you know what? I'm not going to sit here and nickel and dime over how big my chunk is. Sure, we'll screw the West. So these prices go way up. Now, why do they come back down? All right. About I said three reasons. Three reasons. One, and so this was absolutely the height of post-World War II inflation, but without question. And it was a long period of time. And by the way, during which we raised interest rates, which did no good whatsoever. It
Yeah.
was useless, but because it didn't make more oil. But three things happened. One, it became more profitable to look for other oil. So we found other, and we already knew there was oil like in the North Sea, and off the coast of Mexico. It just wasn't cost effective to go get it. Well, now it was. Another was we learned how to do some processes without oil. Apparently, it was really key. And then the other one was Iran. I'm sorry, Iraq invaded Iran. And I can never remember if it's 79 or 80. And this led to Iraq thought, it was Saddam Hussein. He thought it was going to be a nice, quick, easy war. Iran had just had the Iranian Revolution, that led to the U.S. hostages and all that. And they thought, man, we're going to walk in and they're just going to give up. No, it was like the movie Independence Day.
Yeah.
The aliens come in and all the Earthlings gather together. Well, it brought the Iranians together. Rather than them collapsing. So this ends up this long, bloody war, really expensive. So they start cheating on their quotas on how much they're allowed to sell because they need this money. Then other countries are like, well, heck, if they're going to cheat, I'm going to cheat too. Oil prices didn't just stop increasing, they started falling.
Yeah.
They started flooding the market with oil. So and we just never had. And by the way, you mentioned gas prices earlier, and I meant to say this then. That's a particular, even though I said it was only like 3% of the price, it bleeds into everything else.
100%.
Yeah, that's right. So it's such a key energy is such a key
Psychological.
yeah, it's absolutely central to everything else. We never had another problem with that. We ended up with the fracking and so forth over here to create more energy. And it wasn't until I guess Russia invaded Ukraine, but there were some brief incidents in the 90s that I can talk about, but not that interesting. And the other thing that happened in the 80s was that unions became much less powerful. And so the power of the working person went way down. So we just never had any problems with inflation again for a long time.
So let me ask you this question real quick as you're getting there. So when prices remain high like they currently, well, like we believe they currently are, how hard is it to get them down? If like we have that ratchet effect, right? Like prices stay high, and once you normalize it, it is what it is. And then you mentioned previously about raising wages for people. Well, that's going to raise the price for everything else, right? So,
That's right.
like, at what point is it like, hey, well, the grocery stores are going to say you're okay with paying $2 or $1.50 for this avocado that was 70 cents. This is where the price is going to be. We're just going to keep the profits moving forward.
Well, there is no point at which it stops. There
Okay.
isn't. I mean, so it's a constant struggle. I read one time years ago, I fell into a different group of economists. I was trained by the people who say, oh, yeah, you raise interest rates and you lower interest rates. And I just was not buying it at the time. This was in graduate
Is
school.
that Keynesian stuff? What is that? Is that
But it's not Keynes.
okay?
Keynes and Keynesian are not the same thing.
Okay.
And it's like so many great thinkers. People read his stuff like, oh, I see what you're saying. And then they go over here and it's like, yeah, that's not what I was saying.
Okay, I gotcha. I gotcha.
But anyway, so because I'm a big follower of Keynes, but
Yeah.
that's very different from Keynesian. So yeah, it's all the Keynesian stuff.
Okay,
It's all
okay.
the Keynesian and the monetarist stuff. There's really a lot of overlap between those. Anyway, so I remember reading one time when I was exploring these alternate schools of thought that I was trying to find something that made sense to me. And one of them said, inflation is always a struggle over shares of income. It's
Yes.
people fighting it out for more income. So we have to take, and I thought, wow, I'd never thought of it that way
I like
before. I
that.
mean, what was the 73 Arab-Israeli war, the inflation? They were struggling, they were fighting for a bigger share of the pie.
Yeah.
It's not always exactly that way. For example, when Russia invaded Ukraine, this was a supply shock. All of a sudden, there simply wasn't as much grain coming out. And there was a sort of a panic response in the oil industry that drove up prices. But the ongoing thing that you were describing is just a struggle. It's a struggle among different groups, and it comes down to something that economists are very that they tend to ignore, and that is power.
Yes.
I was just talking about this with somebody yesterday, that every other social science, power is a major part of what they talk about in history and in political science and sociology. We ignore it. Like, competition will take care of that. Well, it would if we had competition, the Economist magazine wrote some time ago, and they're a very right-leaning publication. They wrote some time ago that, man, the US economy and the world economy is becoming more and more concentrated. There are fewer and fewer firms dominating, and so they have the power. So they, in this struggle for income that you were describing, there's really no equilibrium point. It's just going to be a constant push and pull to see, who ends up on top. But something else about inflation, the reason the prices don't come back down, because they used to.
But nobody wants deflation, though, right? Nobody wants to be Japan, right?
It used
So,
to happen. It
yeah.
used to happen back before World War I. Prices and wages would go up and down and up and down. But since World War I, A, the government has stepped in to, our recessions are about half as long as they used to be.
And I think that's a huge problem. I think that's a huge problem, by the way. Just
Well,
FYI.
recessions being half as long as they used to be is not a problem, though.
I think what we're doing is we're removing the barriers, but we need the economy. If we're gonna be, and I know I'm sorry, if we're gonna be a true quote unquote quasi capitalist system like we believe we are, then we have to allow things to happen. But the John Smith, the Adam Smiths of the world, and the Milton Friedmans of the world, I know they have two kind of different modes of thought there, but we're so Milton Friedman heavy right now that that there's no more invisible hand. So now we're in this world where like we got to intervene, we got to intervene, and it never allows what we want to be, which is a true capitalist system, to work. That's just my opinion.
I think the bigger obstacle to that is the fact that we don't have competition.
There you go.
Because Adam Smith and Friedman, the benefits of capitalism were supposed to come from the fact that firms didn't have power, that firms were always like this far from being bankrupt, and they were worried to death about what their customers thought.
Yeah.
And that's what I think has really gone away. Oh, and I was going to say the other thing that keeps prices from falling is so many of our payments nowadays are contracted.
Yeah.
My house payment's contracted. My car payment's contracted. So I can't really go down without being. In fact, I was talking about this in class one day, and one of my students was German. And they said in Germany, they adjusted the wages of dentists at one point, and they were going to lower them. And the dentists were like, I got a house payment. I got a car payment. You can't do this to me. I mean, I can maybe adjust some other things. I can have more spam instead of steak or something like that. But I can't adjust my house payment. So I think that so many things being contracted nowadays also creates a kind of a ratchet effect like you're talking about.
Yeah, and you're talking about substitution, the chain CPI effect, and oh, Kevin's not gonna eat steak this time. He's gonna eat maybe some pork chops. I remember a couple of years ago they were trying to bring that in, so that kind of changed the numbers a little bit, but that's an aside. Now let's get to the meat of this conversation: modern monetary theory. Now, my belief is we control what we lend, we control what we spend, and we control the interest rate. We have the power of the purse of the United States dollar. It's the world's reserve currency. We are the kingpin. So she did mention that there's a fly in the ointment, and this is what I remember: inflation is the fly in the ointment. So explain to me, like inflation, government debt, like in the traditional economic models, like explain to me how MMT and us being able to just create more money, how that doesn't impact inflation. And I'm trying to understand and wrap my head around it.
No, and you may find I don't disagree with you that much. But let's see here. But let me back up and just kind of give a sort of a nutshell of what MMT is all about. As a
Perfect.
matter of fact, I'm in the middle of writing an article where we're at the revise and resubmit stage about the history of the evolution of MMT since the 1990s.
Okay.
And the first thing to understand with it is it's not a theory, it's a description.
Okay.
They're just saying this is the way we already do it.
MMD, MMD, okay.
They're just saying modern monetary theory, or Randy Ray, who's one of the big names, he prefers to call it modern money theory. And I said, well, it's what we already do.
Okay.
And so, in a way, it's not a theory. Like my book on business cycles, I've got a theory of what causes business cycles. And I can't totally prove it and can't be totally, this is what I think lines up. This is the data I think that backs it up. They're just saying this is the way it works. It already
Okay.
described. And there's two main components to it. One is that the US government can't possibly go bankrupt. And I can give you pages of appeal to authority is a bad way to argue. Well,
Yeah.
because my dad said so, because my brother said so. But when it's law, then it's okay. And I can give you quotes from chairs of the Federal Reserve, including the current one, that, well, yeah, it's impossible for the US to go bankrupt. And so that should be
When
totally.
people say that, that scares the hell out of me, by the way.
Oh
You know what I mean?
As a matter of fact, funny you should say that. This Randy Ray guy I just mentioned said that one of his mentors said, "Ooh, be careful when you talk about money and financing. It scares the hell out of people." But it's the way it is. And so, I
I'm
mean,
sure the Ming and the Xing and the Han and all those other dynasties felt the exact same way. So I'm just saying.
And I mean, climate change scares the hell out of me, but that doesn't mean not happening.
Yeah, true, true.
So you got to say, okay, I got to get my head around it and figure out what can we do. So when the US government, okay, and I'll give you two quick examples here that hopefully will make it easy to understand.
Yeah.
World War II. All right. In World War II, I was watching that great series by Ken Burns he did on the war. And he has this whole episode on how the US paid for the war itself. All right.
Okay.
that they did these bond drives. And so that's how the US was able to fight World War II. So you're telling me, Ken Burns, that if they weren't able to sell those bonds, we have the productive capacity. We have this massive population. We would, oh, I'm sorry, Hitler, come on in. There's nothing we can do. We ain't got any money. Of course we had money, and we made it up. In 1941, unemployment in the US was still 10%. It was much lower than the 25% it had been in, like, I don't know, 32, 33. But we're still really bad unemployment rates in the US in 1941 when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. So we did not sell bonds to people who are on the heels of the worst economic disaster in American history, still at 10% unemployment, to fund building factories and so forth. Instead, we printed up dollar bills like we always do, and we built the factories. And then we paid people with those dollar bills that were created. Now we got a problem, though, inflation. Because not only have we now lowered unemployment from a height of 25% around 32, 33, to 2% during the war. But we're also not making any consumer goods anymore. We're making tanks and planes instead. So everyone's got this money, so they want to go out and spend it. So if you read the contemporary accounts, and this gets a little bit to your question about inflation, if you read the contemporary accounts of the people who ran the bond drives, they keep talking about dangerous dollars. They keep saying, we need to get these dollars out of people's pockets because they're going to go out there and try to spend it and cause inflation. And they raised taxes during the war. They raised taxes. They had bond drives. The point of that was not to fund the war. The point of that was to prevent inflation. Funding the war, a nation is about resources, a nation like ours. Now, if we're talking about a small developing economy that nobody respects our currency and we have no resources, then we're screwed. We need to find a way to get dollars and euros and so forth. But we don't. As you said, we're world reserve currency. We don't need somebody else's money, but we have to have resources. We can't create something we don't have the people or the resources to make. So that's one example. Where else did the money come from? Then, oh my gosh, COVID. Where did those checks come from? We made it up. We didn't borrow it from China, because they were in worse shape than we were. We didn't borrow it from Europe, because at the time they were in worse shape than we were. We just printed it up. All right. So we can do it. So that's the first point. First point is simply that we already do it. The government creates money. Now, how do they make you want to take that money? There's a guy, Hyman Minsky, very famous guy in my school of thought. He said anybody can make up their own money. The trick is get somebody else to accept it.
I mean, they're already doing it. Look at crypto world.
Well, but crypto, psh, I mean, if somebody, there is an anchor to the dollar. And it's on April 15th. Because the only thing they're taking right now is the US dollar. And that means I got to have some. I got to have some. So, I don't need to have any. I've got two rookie Eric Davis baseball cards that are worth, I don't know how much money, although when he got injured early in his career, they're worth a lot less.
Yeah, he was so good. He was
He
so good.
was, he was. But, and he was good friends, I think, growing up with Daryl Strawberry.
Yes, they're all good friends.
Anyway, if somebody decides they don't care about baseball anymore, those are worthless.
100%.
Or somebody doesn't care about crypto, that's worthless. But not the US dollar, because it's the only thing they accept on April 15th. My wife used to create, in her, she taught fourth grade, just retired last year for like 30 years. She created Harvey Bucks in her classroom, right? She gave these out for people, oh, that was nice of you to help that other kid, here's some Harvey Bucks. Well, why do you want Harvey Bucks for? You got to create an ultimate demand for that currency. You could use it to get out of homework. You could use it to buy something from the prize bin. That's the trick. All right, that's the trick. So that's why the US dollar is accepted, is because we have an anchor demand for it. Now, second big thing, and this is so overlooked. If the US government's in deficit, who's in surplus? You and me. You and me.
Okay. Help expand on that a little bit.
If the public sector is in deficit, then the private sector must be in surplus. If the government spends,
I know the states are currently in surplus, a lot of them, with that with the
right, yeah,
pandemic
the
money.
states are screwed. The states don't get to issue their own currency.
Yeah, I know, I'm just kidding.
But
I
you're
got
right.
you.
The math still works. The math still works. If the government spends more than it taxes, then the private sector got more money coming in than they had pulled out through
That
tax.
makes sense. That makes sense.
And do you know what happened at the end of the Clinton administration when everybody's patting themselves on the back about the budget surplus? Private sector debt skyrocketed.
That makes a lot of sense.
And of course it did. I'm sucking income out of the private sector through taxes. I'm taxing more than I'm spending back in, which is what we're about to do right now.
Ah, oh, God, that's a wrinkle, man. I appreciate that.
Oh,
I didn't think about that way.
it's amazing. The first time you hear that, you're like, oh yeah. Because it's got to add to zero. It's got to add to zero. For every surplus, there's a deficit. For every deficit, there's a surplus. So, and there's a wonderful chart you can look up. If you look up the term sectoral balances, it will show you the private sector's net wealth compared to the public sector's and compared to trade flows,
Okay.
because we also lose income to the rest of the world. So there's really three sectors, but it's easier to start off talking about just the two. So those are the two big things. One, the US can't go bankrupt. And two, the government's deficit is our
I
surplus.
don't
So,
like hearing the first one, but the second one I understand.
but then, but it fits in, doesn't it, though? Because now you're like, well, wait a minute now. Yeah, that's and so then how do we control spending?
Exactly. Yeah, so
Here,
that's my next question. Like, does the government just have a blank check, and how does that impact inflation?
I will tell you exactly.
Perfect.
That book by Pavlina Chernova called The Job Guarantee, A Case for the Job Guarantee, the way they were talking about the major government program that's going to make sure that people can have jobs and have lives and have training, the way they do it is, okay, it's by formula. Like let's say for Tarrant County, if you want to work, you can't get a job in the private sector, so you're going to take a public sector job. And this is one of the places where I disagree with some of my colleagues. I feel like that ought to be your only choice.
Okay.
They feel like you should still be allowed to go on, unemployment. And, well, for a little while, unemployment, no problem.
So you're
But
basically trying to say replace unemployment with a government sector job.
yes,
Okay, I
that's
gotcha.
exactly right. All right. And it's extremely cheap. If you do the math, it is a tenth of the cost of the defense budget to employ everybody. And I did this
And
math.
you're keeping them productive
Yeah,
to a
that's right.
degree.
The fewer people in prison, there are parents that are home there to help their kids out.
I see that work. Okay.
It's just all kinds of payoffs involved. And it's extremely cheap. If you look at how much we actually spent in the from the financial crisis, from the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, something like that, it's a fraction of that. And it took, by the way, 4 or 5 years to get unemployment from 10% back down to 4. We could have had it to nearly zero for a fraction of the price. You're talking about controlling the government spending. When they did that Recovery Act thing, every governor was fighting for a bigger piece of that Recovery Act as they could get.
That's why they have so many surpluses right now. It's like,
Very possibly, yeah. And with the job program though, your governor only gets to claim as many as they got unemployed people. And unemployed people self-identify. They show up at the unemployment office. When the unemployment line is down to zero, the government spending stops. When the unemployed when the economy expands, and this would do wonders for the macro economy too. This would do wonders for profits. There are investment firms that talk about government spending as a direct contributor to profit, and they're right. It generates income for them as well. So the idea of controlling the government spending is to link it to the number of unemployed people.
Okay.
Let's have, I use this example sometimes. What if I could go get air for my tires free at a local gas station? Would that cause me to explode the tires? Oh, God, this air is free. I can't believe it. I'm going to put more and more air in. No, because I got another target. The target is 35 pounds per square inch or whatever. So with this government spending, is the target the size of the debt and deficit? No, because we don't care about debt. The target is the unemployment. The target is the people. The
Okay.
target are the social problems we've got. Now, can that be inflationary? I talk about this in chapter 5 of my book. I go through this whole, I go through the economy and the business cycles up to that point. And I was like,
Okay.
what could we have done instead? And I have a whole chapter on that. And initially, it will be inflationary. Because you know who's going to really be helped by this? People who are minimum wage workers.
Gotcha.
They're going to get pulled up. Well, that means I'm going to have to pay more for fajitas, because restaurants and so forth is going to be more expensive. So there definitely is a once and for all, and it's about that struggle over income. Basically, the government will be representing the poor people and the poorer people, and the people who are relatively well off are not going to get to go out to eat as much. Potentially. I mean, we also have the benefits of there's fewer people in prison and this sort of thing. And then would it be inflationary after that? And all of my colleagues in this area say, oh, no. We can control that, no problem. Well, first of all, you can't control Russia invading Ukraine.
Can't.
So that's going to be a problem. That stuff like that,
The things you don't know, the black
right.
swans,
And these shocks that are going to happen, they're still going to happen. Will there be some upward pressure on wages? I think, yeah. I think, yeah. But I'm okay with that because the economy is supposed to be about us, about the people. And so, is there some upward pressure that's causing some inflation because now we don't have as many unemployed people? I was discussing this with somebody that I know who's sort of a hardcore libertarian Austrian type. And his view was, well,
Wonder
unemployment
what
rate.
that
Well, we have other stuff in common. So we just talk about that. But he said, he felt like unemployment played a useful purpose because it keeps, costs down. It's like, we're not talking about the cost of copper. We're talking about the cost of people. And the cost of people is also their income and their livelihood. And we get one shot at life. And why should you be, screwed? But well, I'm sure you know this, that you can pretty much tell somebody's trajectory in life by their zip code. And so, and I teach it. Yeah.
I've always said that like the bootstraps thing, like I have a special needs son, and I've always said, listen, my son, I said, you can give him all, I mean, he didn't have any bootstraps. I mean, he didn't have any boots. I got to take care of him, right? So I have a different perspective than most other individuals, because I'm going to say some people on either side, well, mainly on one side, they're going to be like, pull yourself up. What? I'm like, stop. I
And
mean,
generally they didn't. Generally
yeah.
they didn't. Or
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. But so the last thing here is, so are you saying that MMT could be inflationary? I guess that's my question.
I
I'm
think
not saying it's a definite absolutely, but like
right.
my thing is like, here's where I come in. So if I give a person $1, right, they're gonna buy goods and services for that dollar. If I give them $10, they're gonna up their purchases, and that's different supply and demand metrics there. You know, at a point certain, there's like a what they call it a marginal return, a marginal utility. Those dollars where it's like $1,000. Okay, maybe I won't buy $1,000 worth of stuff. Maybe I'll only buy 100. What am I gonna do with the other 900? I'll put that into some other productive uses, and I'll bid up those prices in the stock market, right? So it's all about like. That's the way I see inflation. Like, yeah, if you give people money, they're gonna buy more goods and services. And I'll go ahead.
No. I think there's something to that, but I also think that's the good kind of inflation.
Okay.
If you give people money that they go out and they bid up the price of Zep commercial sprayers,
That's the good
guess
stuff
what?
right there.
That's th this it says on here, water for the dog with four in quotation marks. Because if he had bothered me during the interview here, I was gonna have to squirt him.
Get him, you gotta squirt him.
That's right. But I mean, well, then we make more of those. I mean, if it's inflation caused by increased demand, it creates profits and opportunities for entrepreneurs. If it's inflation caused by Russian invasion of Ukraine, which MMT doesn't cause,
Yeah.
that inflation still exists. And what do we do about stuff like that? And I complain about the Democrats as well as the Republicans. But one thing that Biden was doing right was he was making sure that we were trying to shift our sources of supply of chips back to the United States
Yeah.
so that we would not be as vulnerable to things as like happened before. That's how you treat inflation. You invest in industries that you think are sensitive over here. And if there's inflation caused by people having a lot of money and going out and buying stuff, that's the kind of inflation that I'm going out and building a new restaurant
Okay.
about. So, the kind of inflation it causes, I don't see as terribly damaging. All of my colleagues in this area say, no, there won't be any inflation because we'll just raise taxes and suck that income away. I don't know that you can be that specific. I don't know that
Yeah.
you can, but that's my feeling on
Okay, so let's finish off, man. This Dr.
that.
Harvey, this has been a great conversation. You've given me some wrinkles. You've talked
Yeah.
about different aspects of inflation that I didn't think about in the past. So, what do you think are some of the biggest economic risks in 2025 in regards to inflation, in regards to a potential recession, possibly the labor market? In my humble opinion, I do believe this next labor market number, and I'm no telling, this is going to come out next week, by the way. This
Yeah,
next labor
yeah.
market number is going to be a doozy, and the one after
Yeah.
that's going to be a doozy as well.
I
So,
know, I know.
yeah. Yeah.
We
So
have
what, so what,
somebody.
so what are your, some, what are some of your biggest concerns outside of just inflation?
Inflation doesn't concern me as much.
Okay.
It really doesn't. It concerns me that the Fed is concerned about it because we're
Okay.
better off with lower interest rates. But anyway,
So you think the
I'm
Fed should
worried.
lower interest rates?
There's a really good article by a guy named Jamie Galbraith, who teaches down at University of Texas, really well-known economist in our area, called The Case for Low Interest Rates. Really good stuff. But I can send that to you.
Yeah, but I guess my question is, what makes us think that we have to lower interest rates? Are we not normalizing them currently where they should be? Or is there no such thing as normalization of rates?
That's it. That's it.
Okay.
There is no natural rate.
I gotcha.
There is just the rate that the Fed sets,
I
and
gotcha.
that's it. And so we have to ask ourselves, what are our goals? Well, we want people to spend money, and and so to me, raising interest rates can be inflationary. It causes the prices of mortgages to go up, and so it's like, well, you're not even really solving the problem anyway. So I'm not so worried about inflation. I am very worried about the fact that when the government lowers its deficit, that lowers our surplus.
I never thought about it that way. I never
It's
thought. So,
really devastating.
my last question, if you could change one thing about how economic policy is discussed in the media, because I know there's a lot of people from a bunch of different sides, how would you like what would you do? Like what would it
Yeah.
be that you would change?
Can I give you two?
Yeah, give me
All
three. I
right.
don't care.
Because I already thought about this before we came on the air. I was like,
Yeah.
you know what? If I could wave a magic wand, one would be the U.S. government can't go bankrupt.
Okay. That scares me, but okay.
It's off the table. It's off the table. And I guess I'm going to make, so I am going to do three. And that government deficits are private sector surpluses. All right. So I want that to be understood.
That's awesome.
So
I
right
love that.
now, when DOGE is going through cutting spending, they should be saying it this way. By the way, we reduced the private sector's income by X amount of money today. Because that's
Yeah.
what we just did. Because we don't really need the tax revenue. In fact, clearly we don't need the tax revenue. We wouldn't have deficits. We spend more than the tax revenue as it is. Taxes are really for social issues. Like, I'd like you to contribute to goodwill, so I'm going to give you a tax break, but I can't give you a tax break unless I have taxes first. Or I'm going to make sure there aren't billionaires, so I'm going to, but the other thing that worries me is the understanding of inflation. Thinking of it as one number and not breaking down the in. I mean, the whole thing about that right now, the bird flu, we knew about this months ago. It started, as a matter of fact, it started in, I think, 2022.
And there was an instance when what's funny is there was an instance during Trump's first campaign, the exact same time in this first couple of months, and when he was doing the tariffs and everything in
Right.
2017, and I was like, this is very odd. Like it's the same timing on both administrations. Like I don't know if it's either A, scripted by
Right,
someone
right.
somewhere, or B, it's just bad timing. I don't know.
I don't know what the hell's going on.
No one knows what's going on.
And I'm within a couple of years of retirement, and I contacted our guy that takes care of our fund, and I said, "Are you going to be doing anything special now that he's been elected?" And so I think the stock market will be fine. And then the stock market started falling. I said, "This is what I was talking about. He doesn't know what he's doing, or he does, and what he's trying to do is not good for us." Anyway, I'm with you on the unemployment numbers. I'm really worried about the GDP numbers, which I guess
Wow.
first.
No one's talking about that. No
Yeah.
one's mentioning that. I think we're gonna be. There's a chance there could be a negative print, man, and
Yeah.
that could be bad.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's right. And here's the irony. Up until the election, The Economist magazine, a far, not far right, but a right-leaning magazine, said the US economy is the envy of the world. Well, it's not now.
Well, if I was in a room with President Trump, all I would want to know is this. I would say, "Hey, Mr. Trump, how long do you expect for the economy to be bad?" And give me a number. And apparently he said 6 to 12 months a couple of days ago. So I don't know. We
Yeah,
shall see. He said this won't be my economy for another 6 to 12 months.
it won't. He's going to do so much damage. I don't see how. Oh, you know what I would ask him? Hey, did you enjoy the Super Bowl?
Oh, no, not even that. Did he enjoy the Daytona 500 running around on the
Oh, that's right. No, but he was pulling for Kansas City, so I loved watching the Eagles win. So
Oh my God,
anyway,
man. Dr. Harvey, thank you for this. This has been a valuable
certainly, certainly.
experience. Man, you've given me so many wrinkles. Again, I'm glad you've explained the MMT side of things in a way where you weren't necessarily pro or con. You were just explaining it, which is good. And thank you so much for your knowledge. This has been wonderful.
Certainly, certainly.
Where can people, so have you written books before, or is this your first book?
This is my third book. But my other books were on boring stuff. One of them's on exchange rates. The other one's actually kind of interesting. It's on different schools of thought in economics. It's called Contending Perspectives in Economics, and it goes through all the other perspectives. I'm a post-Keynesian institutionalist.
Okay.
And so, there's feminist economics in there, ecological, Austrian. And by the way, something I did in that book that was unique was I asked people from that school of thought to read the chapter I wrote about them. So, for example, I'm not a big believer in Austrian or Marxist economics, but I had Austrians and Marxists read the chapter. And so, whatever they told me to change, I changed. I was like, all right, I'm not going to put something out there that's just me spouting off my opinion. I
Yeah.
want to make sure I've done a good job representing you the way you would like to be represented.
Awesome.
So anyway, that's probably the best one.
If they're at the library, I'm gonna check them out on my app. I'm gonna read them because I
There you
always
go.
like learning. I have a thirst for this stuff, and I appreciate Dr. Harvey TCU. Go Frogs,
That's
man.
right. That's right. Well, let me know if you want to come back sometime.
Absolutely, man. I'll see you again soon.
May the force be with you.
I appreciate that. We had Dr. Harvey of TCU. Professor, PhD, talking about MMT, thorough conversation. I mean, if you didn't get anything out of that conversation, I know it's economics, but the way he talked about all these different things, inflation, global growth rates, banking, how, and this is one thing I got out of it. If you take money out of the private sector, then you should have a government surplus. So government surpluses are in theory money coming from the private sector. So why do you want to have a surplus if you want the private sector to work? Wow, wrinkle in the brain. Thank you, Dr. Harvey, for that. Again, today we're talking modern monetary theory. Is it inflationary? Subscribe to the channel. Go and get my book, MLB to CFP, live on Apple and Amazon. You have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at info@9icapitalgroup.com. Send us your questions. Go to the website at www.9icapitalgroup.com. Schedule an appointment. As you know, we're here to do what? Educate, empower, engage, and also entertain. And today is a straight educational experience. Thank you, guys. Stay humble, stay safe. I'll see you again soon.